It is Friday, May 8th, 2020. My name is Daniel Bader, and this is the Android Central Podcast. This week, joining us again, back with some. Are you in the polar vortex, Jerry? I don't even know if it reached that far south.
Wasn't that a movie with Tom Hanks?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Tom Hanks has run the gamut of every weather-related movie in history. But seriously, no, yeah. are you freezing right now? Because it's freezing here in Toronto.
It was like 70 yesterday, and it's like 70 below today, I think.
Yeah, that's unacceptable, world. Come on, we're already dealing with enough as it is. And I'm so pleased to welcome back Martin Bartza, Tech Altar, as you may know him on the internet, back to the show. Martin, how are you, man?
I'm doing great. No polar vortexes over here. We have very good weather in Berlin.
I don't actually think you've ever had a polar vortex in Europe. I don't think that's a thing that you have.
I don't remember one, so it could be possible.
It means it's basically when the jet stream brings a bunch of Arctic air and has it sit on top of your face for a couple of weeks. And then we get unseasonably cold weather in May, where it snows in New England. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the coldest it's ever been in parts of Alabama right now in mm-hmm. May. It's very strange. If you want to learn more about it, the Washington Post had a really good explainer on what it is. But I wanted to ask you, how's life in Berlin? I feel like you guys must be out of the worst of it since you had a quick, a relatively quick flattening of the curve over there.
Yeah, I think compared to the rest of the world, we're doing okay. People certainly don't seem to be too stressed about the pandemic anymore. People are out and about. Stores have started opening, so you can actually, unless a store is very big, you can actually just go in and shop. You have to wear masks in public transport and in stores, but life is slowly returning to normal. So. Not too bad.
And what does that look like from a bureaucracy perspective? Are people still being tested? Is there still community spread, or is that largely finished now?
People are definitely still being tested. I think Germany has one of the highest testing rates per capita of, I think, almost all the countries in the world, at least all the big developed ones. And they continue to do quite a lot of testing, but there weren't any huge, problems with the healthcare system. There were no big spikes in the emergency rooms. So generally speaking, the healthcare system didn't collapse really anywhere. So I think in general, life is just slowly returning to normal. There's testing,
that's really good news. Actually, yeah. It's quite stark seeing the number of cases in Germany versus its per capita death rate compared mm-hmm. to other countries like Italy, Spain, the US, the Canada, States, basically yeah. every other country in the world. Germany seems to have done a really good job keeping everybody or most people who was infected with the virus alive, which is a testament to the healthcare system for sure.
Yeah, and I think there's two factors. The one that you've said is that the healthcare system was working quite well, and I think the other one is that they did a lot of testing and they did a lot of contact tracing quite early. So probably the reported number of cases actually is way closer to the reality than in most countries. So you just see you see a lower rate because you just have a more accurate number that you're comparing it to, right? The number of cases is more accurate.
That's actually a really good point, because the numbers that we see when we go to our local newspaper websites and check the daily case rates, it's basically reflective of just how many tests they've been able mm-hmm. to perform rather than the reality of how many people are infected, mm-hmm. Except in some countries like Germany and South Korea. So amazing news. I'm really glad to hear that most people are doing well and that you're safe and healthy. I wanted to bring you on the show because you're celebrating something pretty momentous this week. You launched your first app.
Correct.
It's called Crowd, and it is a crowdsourced smartphone review, evaluation, Q&A, FAQ, BRB, WTF, you know, app. And I would love to hear a bit more about it because it's something you discussed the last time you were on the show in January. And I guess back then it was still in sort of earlier alpha stage, but you've now launched an open beta. Anybody can download it with and request an invite code. So tell us about what Crowd is and why you think it's important for the market right now.
Yeah, Crowd is it's an Android app for now. We're going to bring it to iOS and the web at some point as well, but it's an Android app. And I guess the concept is to give tech enthusiasts like ourselves a place where they can review the gadgets that they own. So it's not only for smartphones. You can also review, I don't know, your VR headset, your drone, your Google Home stuff. So you can review all the gadgets that you own. We've developed a whole whole new mechanics for how reviews work on a platform as opposed to other crowdsourced review platforms, because we think that they were quite clunky and we don't really like how they work. And of course, you can find a lot of reviews from other tech enthusiasts. We've been out for about a week, and the response has, I think, has been overwhelmingly positive. I mean, if I expected X amount of excitement, we got 10X. So people have been really, really excited about it. And I guess the concept of Crowd is that there really isn't currently, I think, a good place for tech enthusiasts to for the community that we have to kind of voice their opinion and to let them have an avenue where they can review the products that they own and then to vote about which products they like and which ones they don't like. And we would like to build that community for them.
So, I mean, I just wanted to like publicly hold you accountable for my inevitable job loss, because this is completely unacceptable, Martin. I don't like where this is going. No, I think it's amazing. I think the democratization of product evaluation needed to happen. It's happened through the comments and through forums, but those, as you said, are incredibly clunky.
Yeah.
What was the I mean, you mentioned that previous examples of this were really bad, but what was the impetus for building this particular product in this way, you know, as a mobile app rather than a mobile website, or sort of as a, you know, some other form that it could have taken on maybe a different platform?
So the reason we chose to go with Android is simply because most of my viewers are using Android phones. I think it's about 80%. And obviously TechAuth, our audience, is our first user base. So it just made sense to develop something for, you know, the majority of my audience. So what we wanted to achieve, and kind of this was the original idea for Crowd. I was standing in a store trying to buy a product, specifically an SD card for my camera. And I was trying to figure out if it, like, which one of these SD cards I have to buy that would be fast enough for my camera. And it took me, I don't know, 20, 30 minutes of research in the store on my phone. And I was just so annoyed why I couldn't ask people who own this camera. It would have been such an easy answer. And this is kind of where we realized that there's a lot missing from the review experience online. For the one part, I think professional reviewers like yourselves or like YouTubers, I don't do many reviews, but YouTubers like me, we can only cover so many products. We can cover the latest iPhones, the latest Samsung phones, the latest Jabra headsets and whatever, but there's a lot that we can't properly cover. We also thought that the people who can cover it, so, you know, the actual owners and the community, their current experience is so clunky. Like if you go to an Amazon store listing, for example, you have 5,000 reviews. You're never going to get what those 5,000 people are saying, because it's just 5,000 little pieces of text. You're never gonna read it. It doesn't add up to anything. You can't easily scan it. You can't interact with it instantly. it's I feel like it's a very old school solution. Basically, just give people an open text field and then let them do whatever. So what we wanted to do is to break a review down to its core components, and to make those really easy to both supply and to find what you're looking for. So we have currently two main things you can do on the app. One, you can give star ratings on different features of a product. So, for example, depending on what product it is, let's say you have a VR headset, you can rate it based on very specific criteria that is relevant to the VR headset, like how accurate is the hand tracking, how accurate is the head tracking, if it has a battery, how good is the battery, how good is the field of view, blah, blah, blah. And you can rate these, and it's it becomes quantifiable. So you can see, you know, from the 5,000 users, how many people thought that the field of view was great, how many of them had durability issues, how many of them thought that the, you know, the cable broke easily, and so on and so forth. And so you get a very quick, nice overview at where, you know, having more people actually makes the review experience better. And to go back to my original question, you can ask people, you can ask real owners real questions. And what we're working up to is to get you answers. Hopefully, our plan is to get you at least 10 answers from owners in under a minute. So basically, you can ask, is this SD card fast enough for my camera? You send it off, then the owners get a notification, and right from the notification, they can just tap yes or no on the notification. They don't even have to open the app. And this gives you such quick feedback. We've actually tested this. We now have, we were very selective of who we've let into the app so far. So we have a fairly small user base. We already have 40,000 answers, and people are like incredibly engaged and incredibly quick to answer. And it really works that if you pick a product that this relatively small user base actually owns, then you can really just ask a question and the answer comes back. You can just see the answers pouring in. So it really makes it easier for you to make a purchase decision and to just to decide what's good and what's not. And this way, we hope that we will be able to cover all the products that that are on the market, and not just, you know, whatever is worth reviewing for a professional reviewer.
So I'm curious what you've seen. I mean, you've done reviews, but you also watch, I assume, a lot of YouTube videos of product reviews. You read, I assume, a lot of quote professional reviews, although a lot of our listeners may dispute that we are professionals. They take issue with what we say all the time, which is fine because they're reviews, they're subjective, and that's the way it should be. But how are you seeing the priorities of your user base right now as different to what you typically see from somebody who maybe does this for a living and may be a little bit, if not jaded, then somewhat ambivalent about what they're reviewing because they do it so often?
I mean, one of the clear things that we see is that there's one more thing that I think professional reviewers are typically not very good at doing, and that is giving you a long-term perspective about a product. So there are these like after the buzz and everybody calls it something else, you know, like re-review 1 year later or whatever. But it's hard to get a consistently clear idea about how a product has aged. And we are planning to build out more features in the future that make it really obvious whether a product is not just interesting as it launches, but whether it gets good software support, whether it breaks, whether it is durable, whether it is still a good investment later down the line. So I think that's one thing. And then the second thing is, I feel like we tech reviewers, we live in a little bit of a bubble, and we kind of parrot each other. I think this is, a lot of it is even with the best intentions. You basically think that the community thinks a certain thing. Something is important, another thing is not important. And then I think we all just assume that this is relevant, and then we go along in these these generally assumed directions. And one of the things I hope that the community will show is what the community really cares about. So like you'll actually be able to see, okay, which aspect of a product is important to the people and which aspect is not.
I have a very different approach to reviews than, say, Jerry. I have a very different approach to reviews than, say, Andrew or Alex or anybody else on my team. I love that it does come down to, you know, individual preference. But, you know, what I've always found really interesting, especially about these umbrella brands like Android Central, is that when I personally review a Galaxy S20 on AC, I'm personally reviewing it, but it comes to represent the entire brand's opinion of this product. Mm-hmm. What I love about Crowd is that eventually, with enough data points, it doesn't matter because it just kind of equals out over time, right? If you are able to break down these certain categories, somebody who really, really cares about the camera will be able to filter for devices that prioritize camera features or particular camera features over battery life or display size or something like that. Yeah. What's the evolution of the community or the app, the community within the app, say a year from now, once you hit a critical mass of users? What would your ideal relationship be with that community? And how do you see that maybe impacting the way that a typical Android Central reader or YouTube watcher will make buying decisions if Crowd gets large enough that it's also just a de facto choice in how people decide what to buy?
What I'd like Crowd to be in a year? I have many ideas and many wishes and many dreams. We'll see which of them actually come true. But the first thing is, I would love to, first of all, build up a really good product database. That would be kind of the number one step. And we are actually working on this very hard. I think one of the core, like, kind of infrastructure layer things that is missing from the product review and the product buying and discussion experience is to just have a really nice, free, easily understandable, well-categorized repository, all the products where you can see, you know, when it was released, what the specs are, what other devices it is connected to. I always have this pet peeve that, you know, maybe some of the devices like phones, they have like, you know, you have sites like you know, GSM Arena or whatever that have an okay database, or actually a pretty decent database. But I just like to have an even better database and for all the gadgets as a foundation. And I almost see this as a Wikipedia-like project, especially based on the feedback from our users so far. We have, since we've launched the app, we create our product database manually. So my co-founder and I, we just input things into a database and find images. But we've received, I think, well over 800 product requests from people so far. And we have people who are like very actively now monitoring whenever a new phone comes out, whenever new earphones from a particular brand come out and whatever. So we plan to you know, together with the community, build out a system that where this stays up to date and relevant and well connected. And then we would actually not really like to replace professional reviews. I think you were hinting at this for a little bit, but really we think that it would be a really nice complement to it. So we want to create two things that I think would be really useful for publishers like yourself. One is kind of to give the ability to expose our data and to, let's say, embed it in an article of yours or in your forum, where you can, for example, say, hey, we're doing a re-review. Here's our opinion of it. And by the way, you can see what the community thinks of it. And then this could be embedded into either articles of publishers or on Reddit posts or on social media, basically to become like a source of truth for what the community thinks of any particular aspect of any particular product. Then we would like to go past reviews. So we would also like to let people, like we'd like to turn this app into a sort of news feed almost. So you pick which devices you own and what product categories you're interested in. And then you could bring in articles from, let's say, Android Central or whatever publication into a news feed. We already have a sort of news feed. And then you could follow stuff there. And we would like to let people also express their opinion on products that they don't own yet, not in a form of a review, but in a form of, let's say, you can vote on how exciting you think a newly released product is, or if there's a leak, would you like this or would you like that? Do you like curved screens in general or not? That sort of stuff. So a lot of like news and community engagement stuff, and then hopefully making that data really well structured and really easy to digest and also to expose it to external places. So you can see it not just on crowd, but you can see it on in an article somewhere and so on. I'm not sure if I've answered the question, but
that's amazing. I mean, that's really ambitious. I'd love to learn. I mean, this will obviously play out and we'll have you on the show again once once it's a bit more mature and perhaps once it's public. Mm-hmm. But I before we move on, I just want to ask, do you have monetization plans? If you can talk about them, like what would your ideal way be of earning money from this? Is it ad-based? Is it partnering with OEMs? Is it sponsored placements? Is it, is it charging for access to the API so that you can embed widgets on web pages? Do you need me to be your business manager? Because I could help. No, I'm joking. But all of these, like, there are so many potential ways to make money
yes.
on an app like this, and yet it's so intrinsically difficult to make money from any app that I wonder what your current plans are for that.
We've had all the same ideas that you've just listed here, and honestly, I wouldn't really pick one that will be the one that we go with, because honestly, we'd have to simply try what works and what doesn't work, and we really want to make sure that, of course, this is a community approach, so we really want to make sure that the community feels like they're not being taken advantage of or we're not selling their private purchasing data to whoever, or we really want to make sure that they feel like our monetization model doesn't hurt them and hopefully in fact actually makes life better for them. But yeah, we're playing around with all of those options. And one of the easiest initial thoughts that we have, it's all up for debate and up for testing. But the initial idea that we have is that people have already asked us why there isn't a purchase button in the app. So let's say you find the perfect pair of headphones. You've gone through all the reviews. Now you've decided that this is what you want. Why not, give you a place to, a link to, I don't know, Amazon or your local electronics retailer. And then you have an affiliate business model. So that could be based, because that is actually something people have already requested. So we're looking at it, and we'll see how that goes. And then we're also looking at a lot of other monetization methods. We're thinking of some kind of premium subscription, possibly if people feel that they... That they would want to support the community and they would want to avoid having other monetization models. That is an option. Honestly, it's all on the table. Our current goal is just to make sure that we nail the engagement and the product review experience, and we'll think about monetization afterwards.
Yeah. So where can people find the app and get an invite and all that good stuff?
You can go to crowd.com, so crrowd.com. That's just crowd with two R's. And there'll be a download link for Android there. If you're an iOS user, there's a sign-up link for a waiting list there. And to get an invite, it's also on the Crowd website, but crowd.com/invite is an easy way to find it. And basically, our concept with the invite system is that we wanted to make sure that the people who join the community, at least in the early stages, are a little bit vetted. We don't want just anybody to come in and spam stuff and write reviews of products that that they don't know much about. So there's a kind of a knowledge quiz. You actually have to. We just pushed it out today. That is Friday when we record this podcast. It's actually like people really seem to like it, just as a quiz in general.
That's so funny. It's basically like a little test. People, yeah, of course, exactly. They're going to like it because it proves to you that they're worthy of being on your platform.
Yeah. It's hopefully good for everybody, but we just tried it out today and we plan to refresh it every couple of days. So the questions are always current and stuff. The concept is that there are 20 questions. You have to get at least 15 of them right in 5 minutes. And if you do, we'll email you a code with an invite. We'll email you an invite code.
Well, I appreciate that I didn't have to do the test. I feel like I cheated a bit to get the invite.
Influencer, Dan.
Oh, man. No, I've never been called one of those before, but I know Jerry's an influencer.
I hate this word.
You may be a bad influence, but yeah, you're still an influencer.
Yeah.
I want to shift the topic a little bit. This got my mind thinking to something I wanted to talk about later in the show, but I want to push it up because you were mentioning that there's this inherent bias to the way that professional, and you can't see me quoting, but I will continue to quote, say, professional reviewers, and how we decide what to review. And the industry in many ways, the reviews industry in many ways is broken. And it's broken in ways that it rewards access, it rewards reinforcement, it rewards bigger brands with bigger marketing budgets. It just does all the things that are gross. And, you know, we're a part of that structure where we reinforce the system because we obviously want to be given access to the embargoes that other sites do because you lose out if you don't. But what you mentioned is that it really does lower or suppress the number of devices, products from smaller companies, from companies that are that don't have the same marketing budgets, that or just products that aren't as North American focused, at least for for sites like ours that have a very large US readership. And I talk about this in context of a Canalys report that was issued this morning about the top 10 global smartphones in Q1. So this is between January 1st and March 31st sold all over the world. And while this is just one report from one company, it sheds light on just how different the market is from how perhaps we internally think of it and how we discuss it publicly on the site. The best-selling phone in the world in Q1 was the iPhone 11 with about 18 million units. That's not a surprise. What was a surprise was that the number two, the second best selling smartphone was the Redmi Note 8 and 8T from Xiaomi. And combined with the Redmi Note 8 Pro, which also sold around 6 million units, that's 14 million units of a smartphone that really most people outside of India and perhaps parts of Europe have never heard of and will never get a chance to buy. And it just speaks to how different the market is in various countries and how much influence a company like Xiaomi has in in certain parts of the world and how little influence they have in others. Other interesting notes, the Galaxy A51 from Samsung was the third best-selling smartphone in the world in Q1 with around 6 million units, just over 6 million, 6.5 million. The Galaxy A10s, which is a budget phone, around $150. The Galaxy A20s, Galaxy A01. These are all phones that are sort of trickling into North America and Europe because there's just so much price sensitivity right now around flagships, and we've spoken about how 5G has necessitated this massive year-over-year jump in smartphone prices. But I'd love to hear your take on this, Martin, because you know, Germany, just as a market, is a very different one from where I am and where Jerry is. So what do you see as the dominant narrative around smartphones today in Western Europe?
Ooh, that's a big question. I mean, definitely Europe is, like, one of the big trends Europe is seeing is the rise of Xiaomi. Like, I think they just became the leading brand in Spain, and they're, I think, already number four in Western Europe. I read on a great site called AndroidCentral.com.
Never heard of it.
And so that is definitely a big trend. I think the new iPhones have been doing really well here. But yeah, the mid-range phones are seeing a big resurgence for sure. The A series Galaxy phones, I've seen a lot of people with Pixel 3As, which is the first time I see normal people with Pixel phones in Germany. Didn't see any flagship Pixels before unless they were gadget nerds. So yeah, I think the mid ranges and the, I guess with the iPhone SE, it's going to be the same thing. We're going to see a lot of mid range phones coming.
Yeah, Jerry, I mean, you've talked a lot about this trend and the necessary change that we're going to see. Samsung's obviously trying harder than any other company to bring its mid-range budget phones into new markets to offset some of the price increases that the Galaxy S20 series has. We've just this week, we saw the Galaxy A51 launched in the US widely. The Galaxy A71 5G is launching in June. A lot of the very cheap budget phones like the Galaxy A01, the Galaxy A11, A21, those are all coming to the US at some point this year. What's your take on like the upper limit on what most people are going to be willing to spend on a phone now that there's so much pressure on their budgets, you know, thanks to the pandemic?
I think the biggest thing there is people are not going to buy right now. I think that's, you know, going to be the standout thing. It, you know, I love to see companies, big and small, offer good products for less money. That's really my, and you know, that's my thing. But right now, when money is this tight, I think the first thing you have to consider is that people just aren't going to buy at all. How much of this is going to roll over when we don't have 20 million unemployed people in, you know, in North America, and there, you know, we do have more disposable income? Are people still going to be value conscious because of what they've recently been through? I think that's a bigger story. And I think the answer is yes. And Samsung is going to realize that it needs to offer $400 smartphones, $700 smartphones in tandem with $1,100 smartphones, or it's going to lose a lot of market share to the first Asian company that can get in huge with carriers to make sure their phone is on every shelf in every store.
So this brings us to, you know, back to the story about Pixel 4a, right? We're going to jump into the delay in the Android 11 beta next, but we can't talk about it without talking about the phone that's supposed to be announced or was supposed to be announced at Google I/O, which was supposed to happen next week. We're seeing so many leaks suggesting that the Pixel 4a is imminent, right? We've heard this over and over again, that it may happen as soon as next week or by the end of May. It's supposed to be in stores by the beginning of June. You know, it's possible that it'll be announced the day that the beta drops on June 3rd. But that $399 price point, you know, anecdotally, we heard that was the real benefit of the Pixel 3a, right? Is that it gave you 90% of the Pixel 3, and in some ways it was a better experience than the Pixel 3 for half the price. And that seems to be what people are willing to spend right now.
Yep, I agree. I think the 4a, I mean, we've basically seen some of those photos of the boxes are, you know, they're not sitting in a warehouse. They're in the back of Best Buy. So the launch is imminent. And I really think it's going to come in at the same price as the 3A, just from some rumors I've heard. If so, that's a huge win, and we're going to see, you know, some financial success as far as, you know, its sales.
So you've also made it clear on the website that you'd like Google to experiment with building its own chips, that it might be a better idea down the road to kind of own the whole stack the way that Apple does.
Oh, yeah.
But in the meantime, why doesn't Google partner with MediaTek to produce a Pixel that is considerably cheaper than the ones that they produce today, even potentially cheaper than the 3 or 4A series? Expand on that thought, because, you know, MediaTek just announced a newer, updated version of the Dimensity 1000 flagship SoC that they announced, I think it was in January at CES, but there are no phones that currently support it.
Yeah.
And the older MediaTek chips are not great. They're pretty far behind Qualcomm in terms of performance to price ratio.
Right now, all we can do is look at it on paper, because, as you said, there are no phones with a Dimensity. You know, I don't know. Did they update the numbers? It's still the Dimensity 1000.
Dimensity 1000 Plus. It supports 144 hertz displays and, you know, faster RAM configurations, but otherwise, it's the same chip.
Yeah. See, on paper, that chip is going to perform, you know, in the same ballpark as the latest Snapdragon. In some places, it does things a little better. In other places, it's not going to be as good, but it's going to be, you know, relatively equal on paper. We need to see it in a phone to know how true that is. And if Google is building their own chip, that they need to find ways to move away from Qualcomm for the RF stack and all the other things, or ways to integrate Qualcomm's RF into a custom chip, right now is a great time to try the MediaTek. You know, your phone will be $300 cheaper. It can still have 5G. And if everything MediaTek says is true, which is a big if, it's going to perform just as well. A Pixel 5, you know, we are under the assumption that it's going to have a Snapdragon 765 in it, which I think is a smart move, but maybe a smarter move would have been have a Dimensity 1000 Plus.
Martin, I'd love to know, you know, I keep waiting for MediaTek to have its AMD moment where it kind of jumps into, you know, jumps from a budget, like a exclusively sort of a budget solution for OEMs that don't want to, that are more price sensitive and more region locked, into a true Qualcomm competitor. It doesn't seem to have happened yet, and I'd love to know your take on, you know, whether you think it's possible MediaTek could or will make that jump at some point.
Yeah, I was looking at this Dimensity 1000 chip as well, and I think I had. My thought was that, like, on paper, it looks so good. There must be something wrong with the, either, like, they have problems manufacturing it at large quantities, or they couldn't get the, you know, quality assurance right to they had defective products, or like something in the process had to be go wrong, because obviously people would like to, like companies would like to have alternatives to a single supplier, and I'd be surprised if companies like Google wouldn't pick them up on their chip just to kickstart their ecosystem and to kickstart some competition if it was a viable option. So it means that probably it is not a viable option. Otherwise, companies like Google would have already started using them. So I think maybe they're just not quite there in their technology stack or in their manufacturing as where Qualcomm is.
Yeah, I mean, nobody's where Qualcomm is, and that's by design. there's a lot we've said in the past about Qualcomm's, you know, close to monopolistic hold on the smartphone market in North America, yeah. and all of their patents that require carriers to use their 5G and, you know, CDMA, starting with CDMA and now 5G patents. And you know, we don't want to retread that really you know, well-worn discussion, but I do think it's worth pointing out that I would love to see a real competitor, especially with Samsung leaving the custom chip space, with Huawei or HiSilicon being sort of stymied by the entity list and not really being allowed to work with US companies anymore. Although I do believe that their relationship with ARM has not it stalled for a little bit, but then it started up again when ARM basically decided that they did not have any US dependencies that would prevent it from working with HiSilicon. So I just want to shift the discussion a little bit to the delay in Android 11. So Jerry, we've been sort of waiting for this day, and it was supposed to happen next week at Google I.O. Obviously, Google I.O. has now been canceled. And Google said that due to just the complexity of trying to work from home and all the engineers trying to work independently from home, they are going to be delaying Android 11's beta launch until June 3rd. It's, you know, 2.5 weeks later. But there was an extra developer preview released yesterday or 2 days ago. I don't know my days anymore. And those, you know, the people who are on the developer preview, including our own, you know, Hayato Huseman and Alex Dobie, they're telling us that it's pretty stable at this point, that it doesn't feel like it's disastrous to use it as a daily driver as it was during the first and second developer previews. What's your take on the beta? I mean, it's going to be launched in a live stream. Dave Burke's going to go on stage from Google's campus, socially distanced from the film crew and the very limited number of people that'll be in his vicinity. It's going to be called the Beta Launch Show, and there's going to be a Q&A. It's basically going to be a mini I.O. keynote, but just focused on Android. What do you think is going to come of this, and what are you most looking forward to about the Android 11 beta this year?
Well, first, I hope they fill the seats with robots. I mean, this is Google, so that would be kind of cool, but I really think what we all heard about the difficulties in working from home and all this, I think that's like code speak for, yeah, we're all working decentralized and there was this big bug we had to fix and we didn't find it in time because we're all decentralized. So here's the new developer preview, hopefully with that bug fixed, and we're going to push back a public facing beta for another month while we test it, which makes perfect sense. And you can't be angry about that. You know, they're all working from home and sharing code with each other and sitting and playing on Hangouts Meet and not getting their work done in the same way they were before. So things are going to slip through. And, you know, the good news is, if I'm correct, and I did software development for a living for a while, and I'm pretty sure I'm correct here, they caught it, so that's good. You know, delayed until June 3rd, it's really, how many days is that delayed? we don't know what was supposed to be coming in May is now coming in June, at the very beginning of June. I think people are making a big deal about nothing here. This is just how software development works. We would all love to see a public beta with consumer-facing changes that we think are really cool or that we really hate on, you know, our old Pixels right now. We all would love to have that, but we don't. We have to wait another 20-some-odd days for it. We can wait. What I'm most excited to see, I'm really loving the push towards one-time permissions. Those are essential.
Completely agree.
Security is, first off, it should not be up to the users. You have to stop thinking as stupid users doing stupid things, because that means somebody is enabling a user to do a stupid thing, and that means the user isn't stupid. It's Google's responsibility to let us manage our privacy and security easily. And one-time permissions is, that's so basic, you have to wonder why we're on the 11th version of Android and we're now seeing, you know, them start to get a little bit more, I don't know what word to use, popular, a little bit more in use throughout the operating system. I don't care about whatever changes they're going to bring to the notifications, and you know they will. I really don't care about their messaging strategy. I use Signal. I don't care about any of that. I care that users now have an easier way to manage their own privacy and security, and that's what's important.
So I'll give you a bit of a different question, Martin. You mentioned you are also looking forward to one-time permissions with Android 11. What do you think that Android 10 lacks that you really want Google to bring to Android 11 that it hasn't announced yet? Like, what would your ideal Android 11 look like if you had your way with its design, or are you pretty happy with the direction it's going?
I actually think it's in a pretty good place. I think more work on permissions is required, but I see that they're doing it with each new update. That is definitely my biggest pet peeve. And I think they're doing a decently good job at it. So I'm generally speaking happy with the direction.
What phone are you using right now, out of curiosity?
I am using the Galaxy Note 10, the smaller version, because I can't get used to like super huge ones.
And do you use the stylus for anything?
Yes.
You do?
I have a Surface as well, so I have a stylus in both my PC and my phone, and I draw storyboards, for example, for my editor, for Tech Author, and I also sketch out a lot of ideas for Crowd first with a digital pen, either on my Surface or on my Note 10, and it's just to get. Like, if I have an idea, like, oh my God, we have to put this button here, or we have to resize that, or like, what if you collected feedback in this way or that way, I really like that you can just take out the pen and then start drawing on the screen, and I don't have to, find an app to put it in or whatever, and it just saves, and I get back to it whenever I need to.
So are you one of those people that prefers written notes to oneself over typing on a virtual keyboard?
No. I don't. I never write. I can't handwrite. I haven't handwritten in like 10 years. I'm just sketching things out. So basically, I'm sketching out fake screens, basically.
So I see.
Put little
so
boxes and lines and... Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure it's great to be able to, like, say your Crowd app, take a screenshot and then whip the pen out and actually redraw over top of that screenshot changes that you see in your mind. That's got to be really useful.
That is, yes, very much. And I mean, I really like that, the Note 10 has screen recording built in. I find it very weird that, that's one thing I would like Android to add. Just like a built-in screen recording feature. Like I
think that's on the docket, if I'm not mistaken. It's in the current developer previews.
Oh, nice.
It works pretty good. You'll like it.
Okay, yeah, so I like them very much because whenever we work with our developers, I mean, it's whatever you give feedback, it's either in the forms of screenshots or videos, and it's super useful to be able to draw on top and to just do it natively. And by the way, if I'm allowed to plug one more, we're looking for one more developer. So if you're working with React Native or Node.js, then write us at jobs@crowd.com. We want your CV.
With two R's.
Yes, correct. Jobs@crowd.com.
I always want to make sure that's in there. And I love the Note 10. I have to say, the smaller one, I still use it from time to time. It's just a beautifully made phone. It's a perfect size. I just think, other than the fact that the power button's on the left side, I think Samsung nailed it. I want to ask about the LG Velvet, because that phone has been teased and then LG released or unveiled it for South Korea earlier this week. And this is a brand new design for LG. It really kind of goes back to a more one hand friendly teardrop kind of, influence. It's quote inspired by nature, which is actually, I think, not a great corollary, because it at least brings my mind back to the Galaxy S3 with its like raindrop sounds, which nobody should ever have to hear again. But I want to know like what your thoughts are on the strategy. I mean, this is not an expensive phone by modern standards, around $730 US if you convert from Korean won. It's one of the first phones to run a Snapdragon 765 rather than the 865. 8 gigs of RAM, 120 gigs of UFS 2.1 storage, triple camera set up on the back, including a 48 megapixel primary camera, an ultra wide and a depth, no telephoto, 4300 milliamp hour battery, and IP68 water resistance. It's got active stylus support, just like the V60, which is very cool. And there's a 3.5 millimeter headphone jack. Jerry's very happy about that. So what do you think? Is this enough for LG? Is this just another kind of bump in the road? Is it going to turn their fortunes around? What do you think is going to happen here?
You guys are also thinking that this is going to replace the G series, correct? Like This is probably, they're going to have a V series, which is their high-end flagship, all out, whatever. And then they have like an almost flagship, more design-focused G series, which is the Velvet now, correct? That's your take as well?
I would agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I agree. I think that on its own is a good idea. Like, I think given how many, given the volumes of LG, I don't think that they need two, flagships with the same processor for 1 year. So it would make sense to separate the two and then to really give both like a reason for existence. So the enthusiasts can have the V series, and then the regular people who care more about design and about hopefully polish, because I think that kind of seems to be what they're going for, to make the phone like pretty and nice versus just like throwing all the specs in there. I think it makes sense in general to separate those two. I think the phone visually looks much better than any recent LG phone, at least from the G series. I thought that the G8 and G8S and G8X and whatever, they all looked rather clunky. And I think we geeks like to not realize how much a product looking pretty matters to people. So I think it's not a bad idea to revamp their design. And I think it looks a bit like a Note 10 or like a Sony or whatever, but I think it looks definitely more, definitely nicer than previous LG phones. I just, I wonder whether that price tag is still going to be a problem for them. Like it's not a flagship anymore, not a full flagship anymore. I feel like for $700, having a phone, like there's plenty of phones with a Snapdragon 800 series in that price range already. So I think it's going to be a little tough, but I like it more than their latest G series phone. So I'm hoping that it will bring them some improvement.
I think you nailed it.
Yeah, I agree. Jerry, I want you to finish that thought, but I thought the G8 was a great phone. I actually liked it a lot. I thought the the depth sensing, you know, time of flight sensors on the front that, you know, allowed you to kind of make a claw and manipulate it, you know, air, whatever it was called, like the feature was underwhelming, but the idea was there. And I think LG does that a lot where it has really good tech demos that don't translate into really fleshed out features. And the V series, I just think goes with brute force, and it does a really good job. And I had Juan on the show a couple of weeks ago, some gadget guy, and we were talking about why people are so passionate about LG. And it just comes down to the fact that, like, as you said at the beginning, they get a bad rap in the media. And I think, you know, I posted something online yesterday on Twitter about how people are upset that LG doesn't get the same respect. It's kind of a Rodney Dangerfield problem, right? That LG doesn't get the same respect as Samsung, and that they deserve that respect. And it's funny because I disagree. I think that LG has done this to itself to some extent, but I also agree that Samsung just steals all of the air in the room by virtue of its massive marketing budgets, and that does not always translate into fair comparisons. But I do think that LG deserves some of the blame here as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I do think that there are like things that reviewers I wish cared more about, but I mean it's really on the company to make people care about their product. If people don't care about the features that they think are important, then maybe those features aren't all that important in the end. And LG has done plenty to confuse us reviewers and to make us feel like meh, you know, not all of their products are as exciting as they could be. So, I think design is definitely one of those things. So if they could, you know, polish that up, I think it would be helpful, to say the least.
Jerry, finish your thought on that, because I want to hear what you think before we move on.
I think in North America, this phone is doomed, just like any other LG phone. People are going to see Snapdragon 765. And then a $700 plus price tag, and nobody's going to buy it, because for $2 more a month, they can get a phone with a Snapdragon 865 and 5G, even though they'll never be able to use it, and all these other things that they have been told over and over by phone manufacturers that they really need to have. Part of that, I hate to blame us, but sometimes I have to. We have to care about the phones that consumers care about if we want to stay in business. We can care about other things, but we can't devote... Let's say Daniel is the biggest LG fan in the world. He can't devote a lot of time to say all the good things that LG does, because he has to devote his time to running a business. And when LG can't convince consumers that, you know, these phones are worth caring about, we can't get the message across, therefore nobody's going to care.
Well, I mean, the irony there is that LG is still the third biggest selling, third highest selling OEM in North America, just because of its carrier relationships. And that was a big reason why the V60 was only released at carriers, not unlocked like other LG phones. I'm excited to see what happens. I mean, LG not leaving. I think I had David Ruddock on the show a year ago, and he had predicted that by this time LG would be completely out of the game, the way that HTC seems to have kind of abandoned its smartphone aspirations. So I'm glad that they're still in it and that they're trying new things, because the more competition, the better. I just hope that LG can fix its endemic marketing, its software update, its pricing. It's just like there are things that plague the company for every release, and I hope that finally it can just leapfrog all of them and really compete, because mainstream is important. Whether you care about high quality audio or whether you care about content creation on your device, both of which LG is the best at the best in the business at, it doesn't matter if your fundamentals are bad.
Right.
And you know, the V series is a great series, but some of the fundamentals are just not up to snuff.
You know, maybe LG has fallen into the same trap as Sony. LG is going to make phones forever and lose money doing it because the company itself can afford to do so. That's what we see with Sony today. Sony loses money on every single phone they sell, and they don't care. They want to sell a complete electronics services package to their loyal customers who have a Sony TV, a Sony AV receiver, Sony speakers, Sony this, Sony that. Well, here's a Sony phone. LG is in the position they can do the same thing, and I wonder if that hurts their ability to, you know, they're not sweating trying to make the next best thing, because if they don't make the next best thing, they're going to go out.
I actually feel like, I feel like LG is trying. I feel like Sony has been like really slow in the innovation department, except for, I kind of like their very latest attempt with the Xperia Pro. But other than that, I feel like they have become really stale. I feel like LG is at least throwing things on the market. I think like it's clear that they have they're trying with the Velvet as well. I think the dual screen stuff might or might not be the right thing for most people on the market. I think it's an okay solution, but you know, it's an attempt. I'm happy that they're in the market and that they're trying, and that for some people, they're still, I think, a pretty good choice.
Yeah, we're giving you like a thumbs up with the "you're trying" badge, LG. You know, we're on your side. We want you to do well.
I have to add, by the way, that I have convinced some of my friends to buy LG phones because simply they become ridiculously cheap after a while, and I have yet to hear any one of them complain about the lack of software updates or all the things that we as geeks really seem to think that, you know, they're the end all be all of a phone, or you know, the fact that the bezels are a little thicker than the other stuff. And I've really not heard any of the complaints that I was expecting to hear from them. And so, you know, I think maybe this is one of the things where our bubble just cares about different things than the rest of the world. So,
well, that's why you have Crowd, because you can capture exactly all of them. Right.
We're going to see what the people think.
I'm bringing it back around to the beginning here for you, Mark.
Yeah. Well done.
No, just finish that. You're saying we're going to wait and...
Yeah, we're gonna wait and see what people actually think about products. I mean, it's gonna be one of the interesting things that you will actually be able to feel the pulse of the community, hopefully, and you're gonna be able to see if people actually care about LG or if it's just three people who are shouting loudly. You know, like it's gonna be hopefully showing in the numbers what trends there are.
I mean, that's basically Twitter in a nutshell. But
yeah,
hopefully you can organize it a little bit better so it's not just... they don't get all of the attention. That's the one thing, right? You have to have a little bit more oversight than Jack. Don't be like Jack, Martin.
I'm not planning to.
Okay, so we've gone a little over, so I'm not going to bring up the last... I was going to talk about Google's new more coherent messaging strategy. So I'll just end it on this note. What do you use primarily to talk to your friends and family now that everybody's at home? Do you use a particular video chatting service, Martin?
So I've tried to convince everyone to join Signal for just chatting with medium success. So a lot of people I've gotten some people to switch. My dad is on it. My girlfriend is on it, and so on. And we do video call of it as well sometimes. With my grandma and with my family, I use Skype mostly for video calling, because that's just, you know, how we've always done things. And we use Google Meet for Crowd because we have a G Suite subscription. And I mean, we are in Discord now. We have a Crowd Discord with the people. So we're doing voice stuff over there as well.
So it's all over the place, just like everybody else.
Yeah, I've joined a lot of Zoom meetings with friends lately. I've been in Slack calls. It's really everywhere.
it's a freaking mess, man. Like nothing. Yeah. There's no coherence. You know, Google may be trying to fix its internal messaging strategy, yeah. but just the world can't agree on what makes sense. So that's why Zoom has become so popular, because yeah. I think people are just like,
yeah, whatever. Give me a link. It works. The end.
Low hanging fruit.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being here, Martin. It's been a pleasure as always, and we'll have you back soon when Crowd goes out of beta. Hopefully, when do you think that'll be? Just judging from the early impressions,
I have absolutely no idea.
All right. Well, you let us know, because we'll have you back when that happens.
Awesome.
Unless it's
thank
like
you.
2 years from now, because then we'll have you back before then.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if people want to find out more about you and about your YouTube channel, which is still incredible and people should go watch, where can they do that?
I am Tech Altar on all the platforms. So Tech and then Altar, basically. YouTube, Twitter, those are my two most active platforms.
And you're still doing your Friday checkouts on Stories, right?
Yeah, I literally have to go and do them now. Because I haven't done them yet, and it's Friday and it's 6 p.m., so I have to go do them now. I will be releasing a new Tech Altar video today on Nebula and tomorrow on YouTube. So that content is also still happening.
Beautiful. Well, I'm glad to hear that you're trying to balance content creation with building an entirely new platform for reviewers, because that's not even close to as ambitious as most people. you're doing amazing.
It's a lot of work.
I'm surprised you're sleeping.
But I really like it. I'm not sleeping a lot, but
okay, good. So I really like doing it.
So I'm happy where I am.
Congrats on the launch. It's an amazing achievement, and I can't wait for more people to check it out.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think you're onto a really great idea here. I was telling Daniel that before the show. I think this could be the thing that really goes big.
I'm very, very happy to hear that.
when you get your unicorn billion-dollar valuation, we'll be able to say we knew you when.
Yeah, just don't forget about us.
Just don't sell the Facebook. That's all we ask.
Oh.
Ooh, I will. Yes, that's one of my cornerstones that I will. I will not. Yeah.
I love that. I love that you can say that. I will be popular, but I will never sell to Facebook.
I really hope so. but it's one of my goals in life to not sell to Facebook. So that makes it even better.
That's just an admirable goal in general. Don't sell your business. Don't sell your soul. Don't sell your data. Don't sell anything to this company, period.
Yeah.
Okay, that's it. Jerry, you're at GB Hill. I won't give you a plug because you're the best, and people should just go read your stuff on Android Central.
Hey, I recorded this, so sometime down the road, when I've done something that makes me not the best, I'm going to replay it.
Like, that's fine. You can replay. It doesn't mean that I'll forgive you at the time, but you know, you can try your best. You can leverage it as some sort of blackmail later on if you need to. And I'm always just so grateful that people listen to this. If you have any feedback for us, if you want to get in touch about anything we talked about during the show, email us at podcast@androidcentral.com. I'm at Journey Dan. This is the Android Central Podcast, and we will be back next week talking about Chromebooks with our favorite Chromebook nerd, Ara Wagner. So stay tuned for that, and have a great week. Bye-bye.
Bye, y'all.
Bye.